Welcome to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. We travel to or invite the movers and shakers of the mobility, energy, and climate ecosystem. Listen in and enjoy the talks.
So I'm very excited and honored today to welcome another guest to an episode of our Nectar Conversations Journey. And today I have a special person from Toyota Motor Europe and in Quinto, Nicola Talantana. We met a couple of times in the rearm of Toyota Open Labs. So Nicola is one of the key driving persons of Toyota Open Labs. And this is where we get to know each other. Had a couple of encounters together. And I thought the topics that Nicola is working on are so interesting also for what we are doing in the mobility side that I just asked him for an interview. So Nicola, thank you very much for taking the time. And again, honored to have you here. Maybe let's start with an easy question. Can you talk a little bit about your background, your roles within the companies?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me here, Christian. I'm really glad and happy to have a conversation with you. You spend a lot of time thinking about mobility, so always had very engaging and very interesting conversations with you. So thanks for inviting me to this series. My name is Nico. I'm Italian. I come from a city called Parma, like Parmesan cheese and Parma's ham. I live in Brussels with my family. I started working on mobility many, many years ago. I was first a lobbyist in Brussels. I used to work for a cabinet of public affairs, as they're called nowadays, looking after transportation issues. And one of my clients at the time, this was 2001, was Segway. So I became very, interested by mobility then and what innovation and mobility could bring to the life of people, especially people living in urban areas. So my journey in mobility started then. I worked for that company, for Segway, for 13 years. I look after regulatory affairs, sales. We set up the distribution for an electric vehicle. And it was the first global brand that created a global brand. At the time, the company was not making kick scooters. It was only making self-balancing machines. So the wheels in an axis. So regulatory affairs was a big challenge because there was no legislation or no permit for it to be driven on the road. So that was my first task. And then in time, I moved to different positions. I was VP of sales and marketing. So I had different positions until I left in 2014, at the end of 2014. And I started working for medical device companies, so wheelchair companies. And in that period, I also worked for quadricycle companies, so light quadricycles, to be precise. A company called Estrema that is still making, one of the pioneers of the quadricycle industry. So I started working with them. Worked for a Japanese manufacturer of wheelchairs called Wheel, and also a Swiss one called Jenny Mobility. And then in 2017, I joined Toyota Tsusho, the Toyota family group, first with Tsusho, then Quinto, and then more recently, about 3 years ago, I joined Toyota Motor Europe, always looking at mobility and what we call micro-mobility, if you want to be precise, and looking at titles. I that's my specialty, if you want. So that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah. It's really interesting that there's this something like a red thread going through all the roles and companies that you've been working for, right? In whatever sense, it's been mostly connected to mobility in the special and special formats specifically for that. So I find that very interesting. Nico, looking back, is there a project or milestone that you are, let's say, most proud of, where you say this was a game changer also for yourself and a turning point for your career?
But one of the things that I'm mostly proud of is one of the first breakthrough that we had. And I'm not saying that because you're Austrian, but I remember the feeling of receiving the first letter of confirmation that we would be allowed to be using our devices at Segway on public space. That letter came from Austria, I think in 2002. Mm-hmm. And so I remember a letter signed by a director of a Ministry of Transportation or somebody from the cabinet of the minister confirmed that. So I remember then, thankfully, this was the first of many letters that we have received confirming after some battles as well. But yeah, that's something that I remember as me and my team having impact on something that I thought would be changing the way that people get around, or making it easier for people to get around with different vehicles.
Yes. And thanks for sharing that. I think I can resonate very well with it, because I know when at the beginning, it's just an idea, right? It's just an idea of something to change in the real world. And then when then actually this happens, even in the smallest case, in this case, it was a letter from the small country of Austria confirming it, right? It is a tremendous step forward. It is like an extreme success feeling coming into play there. So congratulations and thank you much for sharing that. When I was last time in Brussels visiting you, you showed me the your FT knee vehicle in Brussels, right? It was one vehicle displayed in the headquarters, and I was generally amazed by the practicality of it, because it is really an outlier in terms of how cars generally get bigger and bigger and bigger, and this is the contrary, right? So what inspired the design and the concept behind it to go that route for you?
Well, this concept vehicle that you saw, called the AFT, Future Toyota Micro Electric, that's the full development of the acronym, is in fact the representation of, let's say, of the vision that Toyota has about small mobility, or micro mobility, as we call it. We have a different way to kind of conceive micro mobility. This is for us micro mobility. People tend to associate the word micro mobility to active forms of micro mobility. So it's important to say that for us micro mobility means basically quadricycle for the time being, but it's the result of a journey that started many years ago, even before the Olympics, with something called the iRoad, which is a sort of hybridization between a motorcycle and a car, very, very, very narrow, 90 centimeters wide. So like a motorcycle with a lot of stability when turning, thanks to an active, let's say, suspension system that would allow to stabilize it. There have been some iteration of small vehicles. There is a K car iteration called the C-Pod that is being marketed in Japan. There is another vehicle from the group called Coms that is also four-wheeler, one-seater. So there have been some, efforts by the company to try to explore this category already, or this family of vehicles, to be able to fulfill something that we strongly believe is needed, which is a vehicle that will allow for short trips within urban areas, or in the immediate, let's say, vicinity of the urban areas, so that you could actually have a certain level of convenience and a certain level of safety, but with a footprint that is a fraction of what is normally associated with a four-wheeler. So convenience is a key element. These vehicles are conceived to be serving very small errands, very short errands, they say 3 to 5 kilometers, and they are of course designed to be transporting one or two passengers, and they generally have, and that's also because of regulation, a top speed. In the case of Europe, it's 45 kilometers an hour. And so that is what DFT is actually fulfilling as a mobility a need.
And it's interesting when I talk about this vehicle to others, the speed limitation is something that comes to mind very early, right? And then at the same time, I remind people that actually there are a lot of cities which are now bringing down the speed limits anyway to like 30 kilometers an hour. Like most of Paris is like that right now. A lot of Italian cities start to be extremely restrictive. Also here in Austria, in Vienna, a lot of the big areas are limited to 30 kilometers an hour anyway. So it is not anymore a, let's say, a disadvantage in mobility scenery. So is there, when looking back, because the vehicle that I've seen in Brussels is the output of a long, long process, was there a, let's say, a big technical or market challenge that you faced when bringing this concept to life?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about the reduction of speed. This is something that I think we can now define as an irreversible trend. This has already been adopted by a number of cities and is there to stay. No city went back to introduce a higher speed limit. There are benefits in terms of pollution, acoustic pollution reduction, increase of safety. There are many reports that are listing the benefits of these moves, and this will happen. I believe this will continue to happen in the next few years. In some countries, they're introducing it country-wise. There's discussion now in Greece, for example, to counter the increase in road accidents that are affecting the country to limit that. So this is one of the elements. In terms of technical limitation, of course, the challenge is that the category was created in after the Second World War to connect rural areas with city center in situations where you didn't have a very high level of alphabetization and also disposable income. So in, let's say, areas that are typically disconnected with farmers and lack of public transportation, this was a category that was able to serve as a connector between the rural areas and the city center. And the category more or less was defined in terms of technical features at the time. So there was a mass, there was a certain size, and of course there was a certain speed to make sure that there is consistency with the fact that the vehicles needs to be small. Also, in terms of size, this was conceived to be used in small streets. You have to think of French and Italian villages, very narrow, designed during the Middle Age. And these ape cars that would be able to go in between small streets with a certain payload to transport things and people. So those limitations stayed. And of course, today they transformed. They have added the batteries. At the time, this was not the case, but there are also mass limitations that are there. And of course, this limits the ability of building vehicles that have the same, that can fulfill the same safety expectation associated with full-size vehicles. It's important to say that these vehicles, and that's also one of the reasons why the speed is limited, they are safe in certain environments. That's why you cannot use them on the highway. And therefore, that spirit and that, philosophy, it's respected in the fact that there are technical limitations. And of course, as engineers, our colleagues have to had to take into account when designing the concept all these elements to make it compliant with the existing regulations.
And I think what you just mentioned there, it really hits the point for me, and that is it's about the context where you put those vehicles in, right? Because I sometimes hear, yeah, but these vehicles are not safe when driving on the highway. Well, it's not supposed to be on a highway. It perfectly fits the purpose to be a short distance vehicle in a certain environment where speed is generally lower. And hence the safety, I think the level of safety for that context is as high as it would be for other categories, right? In their respective context. So I think that's extremely important to consider. What I was honestly really amazed about, it seems to be more than a practicality now. I've been in Amsterdam and some other cities in Benelux, and I've seen also Paris. I've seen tons of micro cars now being used as a hipster item, right? It's not necessarily about being practical, but also about showing off that I don't have to have a huge SUV to stand out. But sometimes the handbag that the lady driving the vehicle cost more than the vehicle she was driving.
Yeah.
Right? That was in Amsterdam. It was really interesting to see. And it's like, it's totally new to me. Being more in Eastern oriented city, like Vienna. Yeah.
Yeah. No, indeed. There is a, let's say, a lifestyle that is associated with this that came, to be, the case, especially in the last few years. There's a few examples of companies that have completely embraced that vision. One that comes to mind is Microlino, for example. They really embrace this idea that you can be small, but you can also be luxurious in the way that you project your image. Traditionally, these vehicles were using diesel engines, so only recently with Estrema was the first one that introduced, I think it was 2012. And then slowly, let's say, there was like introduction of different vehicles from different regions as well. But the ones that made the, let's say, the big difference, of course, was Citroën AMI that came in 2020 and really changed the category, let's say, because before it was basically dominated by diesel engines in terms of volumes with the French companies, mostly Ligier and XM being the two leading companies. And then since 2020, with the electrification and also with the affordability that Stellantis group brought to the category, selling with vehicles that are very affordable from an economic point of view, this changed a little bit the nature. In the meantime, the regulation made it more difficult for people to own a second car, for example, in the city center. What you mentioned about Amsterdam is quite interesting, because as a household, you cannot register the second car in the same address. So the only way for people to be able to have a vehicle, to register the vehicle within the city center, within a certain perimeter of the city, it's actually to have a light quadricycle. So regulation in this case, parking regulation of the city was helping. So therefore, you have something that increasingly is also, just like anything else, is showing with maturity normally comes a segmentation where you have the entry level and then the more premium iterations of it. And that's a sign of maturity, basically, of the category that is has reached in the last few years.
Yes, yes, Nico. And I didn't know that with about Amsterdam. This is actually, it totally explains why I saw that high number, right? And I saw it in the context that I just described. That's super, super interesting. So we're talking about maturity. So I think I recently, you know, latest investor newsletter, I called it Mobility is Back, because I feel a lot of the even categories that were written off by the investment world is actually coming back in different forms, and is finally proving to be successful. Maybe not in a hyperscale way, right? Where, like, investors sometimes were hoping for, but in a very healthy and organic growing way. And I'm convinced that this is gonna shape our mobility environment. Just one thing I really am interested in your opinion on. Like, when I was born in 1976, so a kid of the 70s. And when I remember when I was a kid and I went into a supermarket, it had a certain, let's say, assortment of supplies, right? You had, I don't know, per product category, you had maybe one, two, maybe three different kinds, varieties. It was really limited. When now I go into the supermarket, I can choose between 25 different kinds of ketchup, right? Well, they're all ketchup at the end of the day, but the variety is got tremendous. I think it 20 or 30 folded in terms of how many different products you find into an average supermarket within the last 20 years. Do you think, taking this analogy into mobility, do you think in mobility we'll see something similar, that the variety and diversification of, let's say, categories and different use cases and lifestyles that exist will lead to even bigger diversification in the field?
Yeah, it's a fact. I mean, it's probably the effect of globalization that is increasing the offering. Before, you had, when we were kids, I belong to the same category. There was two choices between cars and public transportation. There was not much. There was no infrastructure for active micromobility like bicycles. So it was, as in Austria, you would not be able to use a bicycle unless you were like an athlete. So indeed, one of the things that I think I can observe about mobility is just like it happens in other fields of other industries, is that there is a segmentation, strong segmentation. So now people expect to have the right form factor for the type of trip that they're taking. That, in that spirit, I think the quadricycle category of the FTME is very important, because it provides the right solution for the right type of mobility need. So it's proportionate, so to speak. In general, in the 70s, but the other big transformation is that in general, in the 70s, to use the same analogy, your driver, your mother or your father will drive you in front of that store, which would probably be a lot smaller. You would probably park in the street in front of that small, it was not even a supermarket, it was like a shop. And then you would just park there. The density of vehicles today doesn't allow you. The regulation today would make it such that you would need to park in designated spots and pay for it as well. So this is changing completely the relationship that you have with your city. And therefore also the vehicle that you use should be evolving with it, which didn't happen at the same pace. Let's say the cities are transforming much faster than the mobility offering. And of course, today it's a different scenario. Today you walk out and you cross path with all sorts of vehicles, cargo bikes, kick scooters, mechanical bikes, quadricycles, monowheels. So today that's offering of mobility is absolutely happening. So not only catch up, but also number of wheels and size of vehicles is being, the offering is increasing, thankfully.
Yeah, it is. It is very much so. And this leads me to the next question, because like a family like me, we're two kids, you called it the right solution for the right needs, right? And I have our family has really a lot of different needs. There is maybe the wish for a, I don't know, cabrio type of vehicle when we go for a weekend into a nice place in the countryside, right? There's maybe we go into the mountains for skiing, so I need space, right? I need a lot of space for all the ski gear to take with me. There might be with friends, I do an outdoor trip into the woods, so I want something that is capable to go into steep terrain on off-road and stuff like that. So a lot of different use cases. Does this mean with the diversity and variety of different vehicle categories coming into place, that this will also accelerate usership driven models and not necessarily ownership driven models? Because I don't need to own five different kinds of vehicles necessarily, right? But for some cases, use cases, I would like to use one that fits that specific need much better. So you think with the further diversification, there's also a trend towards usership-driven models?
Yeah, I think this is really something that we can expect to see increasing. There are signs, of course, the fleet of sharing cars and sharing fleets in general. More active micromobility is also affected, of course, by that. In fact, it's driving, completely driving. The increase of electric bikes shared schemes and kick scooter schemes is there to prove this. And even the full-size cars sharing schemes are increasing, that the number of vehicles are increasing. There's a lot of consolidation going on in the industry, but a lot of companies going out of business. But overall, the fleets are increasing. So I think it does make sense what you say, there is an expectation that our model going forward will be a subscription or a form of usership rather than ownership. That's for sure something that we expect. Let me say something about the car, because indeed, in this transformation of the offering, the car still holds a very prominent role because of the flexibility that it offers. I mean, if I've been thinking a lot about this, and I've been thinking about the reason why there is such a strong power by, let's say, a strong role that the car continues and will continue to play in the mobility spectrum. And the reason is that it offers the highest level of flexibility. It's your locker room, is your family long trip or holiday vehicle, is your, it can serve as a commuting, or it can be used also for short trips. And so when you have when you own a car, let's say you have all the maximum possible. Of course, the downside is that if everybody's got a car and the density continues to increase in city center, it's obvious that it will not be possible for everybody to have a car and use it. And therefore, there is this need to, let's say, centralize the ownership and make it and go towards a model where you are. And when you do that, when you embrace that, let's say, usership idea, then of course you detach yourself from the idea of owning the vehicle, which is also very emotionally attached to you and very, very much attached to the social, let's say, image that you want to project. But once you let's say you disconnect from that, of course, using a kick scooter for a short trip or a bicycle because you feel energized, or cargo bike because you want to do the grocery but you still want to move, it's of course something that could be appealing to an increased number of people. Today, of course, it's very important to say that when we talk about mobility, we tend to think about active young users. It's very important to say that not everybody can ride a bicycle. So the expectation that everybody, you know, from one day to another will be able to give up there and start riding a bicycle, it's, let's say, a bit naive, I find it. It's great that a higher number of people are embracing this active mode of transportation because it's healthy and it's very convenient, it's very affordable. But we have to be able to make sure that everybody's got a solution for mobility, and public transportation, of course, does not have all the answers. So therefore, we also as Toyota promote something called Mobility for All. And in addition to, of course, the car, which everybody knows about, there are projects that are looking at improving the design of wheelchairs. Also, like we said, quadricycles, to me, it's a great inclusive because you have the best of the worlds because you have a good level of safety, but the size and the energy consumption is very limited. It's very democratic, meaning that you don't have to be an athlete. It can be used by all sorts of people, including elderly people. And therefore, it's a great way to keep the independence, socialize, keep the social aspect of your life, even when maybe they take the B driving license away from you. And that's the last thing that I want to say, or another thing I want to say about this category, which we didn't mention. You don't need to have a B license or a full-size car license to drive it. My daughter is in the process of getting a driving license, so I know exactly how much it costs. It costs a lot of money to on average, it costs about 2,500 euros in this neck of the woods. And this is, of course, an element that is discouraging young people from getting a driving license. And in the last 20 years, we saw about half of the population, of teenager population, that was, for which it was possible to get a driving license, to postpone or even to eliminate the moment where they take a driving license. So this is something that is telling about the appetite that the next generation of mobilist, as a friend of mine like to call them, will think about. And therefore, it's also important to mention that in this quadricycle category, you don't need to have a e-driving license. An AM driving license is sufficient, which is a simplified, more affordable, simpler to get. And therefore, this is also a big appeal for people that don't want to, invest that amount of money for full-size driving license. And then tomorrow we could argue, you know, whether for the future generation we'll actually need with autonomous cars will come the moment where maybe the driving license is not needed anymore. It's going to be a while. But for the time being, this is one of the drivers of this category.
Yes. And thank you for mentioning it, especially the growing segment of elderly users, right? I see it with my own parents. They're in the mid-70s now. They live in a rural area of the western part of Austria, which is like mountainous. There are no big cities. It's a lot of villages. And to get your daily errands, no, their bicycle is not an option. Walking is not an option. It's too far away. It's too heavy. They're not as mobile on their own feet. And at the same time, do I have to have a drive a full-blown car? No, not necessarily. For their use cases, 99% of the use cases that they have, no, you don't need that. So it's way, way, way easier to go into the micro segment. And as you said, maybe not with your full capabilities on the sensory field, but still being able to fill the requirement to drive a micro vehicle is maybe a solution. And as we take a look at an aging society in Europe specifically, so the amount and share of elderly people within the entire society is growing quite significantly in Europe, right? I think Toyota is in that sense also very much leading thought leadership in that aspect, because they know you know, exactly from Japan, because I've been traveling in Japan a lot and talking also to politics, and the biggest worry is around the aging society and solutions to enable an aging society to still thrive, right? And develop quite well. And I think that falls in this category. Nico, taking a look into the future, can I play a short game with you?
Of course, yes.
Okay.
My kids do that all the time.
Perfect. So let's put ourselves in the time capsule, yeah, the two of us, and I beam us into the year 2035, so 10 years from now. So from that position of 2035, you look back at the two of us in the now. Yeah, what advice would you give the two of us?
That's a very interesting question. So in 2035, looking back today and try to give us an advice to change something, right? So 2035 is the moment where the zero emission vehicles will kick in. This is being confirmed so far by the European Commission. This is when every new car will need to be zero emission. If we look at what we could do today, you know that Toyota is one of the few companies that is advocating for a multi-path way, meaning that we don't want to be pointing one specific technology because we believe being a global company that's the need for mobility is so different in different environments that is pointless to say that everybody needs to drive with the same technology, with the same powertrain. So we offer from hydrogen to plug-in hybrids to full hybrids to cross-battery electric vehicles. So the full range, and then the consumer is able to choose what is best for him, her. So I think this is something that Toyota is already doing. So one of the things that I would like to maybe suggest from 2035 is that the automotive industry is going through a lot of transformation, and a lot of it is very painful because it requires a lot of investment and a lot of hard decisions because you have to choose between different things. Designing is choosing, so you have to basically make a lot of choices, very, very hard choices sometimes. And one of the things that I would like to be able to say in 2035 is that the industry, even the automotive industry, looks at trying to be as courageous as possible to really challenge itself to come up with even more disruptive solutions. And this electrification challenge is a big one. It's a huge one. And so therefore, the risk is that every resource is aimed at trying to do that. I wish and I hope, and I know it's the case for us, but maybe also it's a wish for the industry that we look, including form factors. Why not? Including form factors. So try to look at whatever take CO2 compliance, for example, whatever is helping the, you know, to get away or to reduce the level of carbon emission, CO2 emissions, should be favored regardless. So these are, I like to give the advice to ourselves in 2035, not to be, let's say, only thinking about electrification, but also think about any other form factors, for example, weight or change of habits or change of business model. You mentioned the move to usership, and make sure that that's attention is kept where it needs to be.
Yes. Thank you very much, Nico, for being so so open about that. I appreciate that very much. So it is a call for courage I take with me to be courageous and courage sometimes means also being hard to ourselves, right? When it comes to not going the easy way, maybe the more painful one, but with the long-term future and long-term prosperity in the view. Nico, thank you very much for this conversation. I enjoyed it. It was truly enlightening. I learned a lot, and that's always a fantastic sign. It's been a pleasure having you with us today. And yeah, I hope that the call for courage resonates with a lot of people in our industry. And I leave you with the closing words for this session.
Well, thank you very much. I also enjoyed a lot this conversation. As I expected, you really touched on with your question to stimulate good thinking, things that I care about, that I'm passionate about. So thank you for that. I really enjoyed, and thank you again, you and your team, for setting this up and for broadcasting this, and looking forward to hearing your voice and my voice again online in a few occasions. Looking forward to that. Thank you again, Christian.
Wonderful. Dico, thank you. Yeah, and have a great summer. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. Subscribe and tune in again next time.